was really not a good engineer. He was more of a salesman. We figured out pretty early, but he mentioned to me Mike Story, his name, who worked with him at Litton, and said, this guy is really the person you're looking for. And so we brought Mike Story, hired him away from Litton, and he had been aware of the quadruple from the group at SRI. And Mike had a lot of, he was good with his hands. He was a chemist, but a vacuum chemist. And so we really needed somebody like that. And so we kept Tom Conklin to help, first of all, in, you know, help Gopher and doing things.
Right.
We recognized his potential as a salesman somewhere along the line. So we had, we hired, subsequent to that, hired a manufacturing fellow who became manufacturing manager, Richard Greenan, and hired Lauren, the person from SRI, with their permission, hired the guy who'd been doing the moonlighting.
Okay.
We hired him full time, and he was a double E. He was, you know, sort of a Mustang type double E. He had come up through the ranks and was, I don't think he had a degree. But he had worked for Cam Shoulders at SRI and was very, very good.
What was his name?
His name was Lauren Wright.
Lauren Wright.
And so Lauren and Dick, Greenan, Mike Story, Tom Conklin, and I were all at this point working on it, and I was finding people. I'd found people to take care of a lot of the things like the computer lab, where we're doing rental work, and we continued to do this process control stuff, but I have to say we probably de-emphasized it at this point, recognizing that this, you know, might be a huge opportunity.
Right.
And so we were in a building where we had space to expand, and so we started to take over various parts of the building, and it actually, for EAI, it wound up handling everything that we needed over the next year or so. And we had, at this time, we had almost next door to us, right down the street, was a company called Altec, who were an ultra-high vacuum company selling ion pumps and other associated equipment for things like Stanford Linear Accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
They were selling them broadly. And they had a salesman who was always, we were probably buying this or that from, but he got in. We were doing all of this work in one room, a little bigger than this room here. I think it was 20 by 20 or 20
right.
by 25. And we called it the secret room. and I tell stories about it, even at Mike Story's retirement party recently. We kept the doors locked all the time. My boss had said, you know, whatever you do, I don't want Chris learning about this from you guys. Or he said, it's my job to tell him, but I'm not ready yet. And so he said, I'd like you to keep it quiet, you know. And he said, because we might kill it any time
right.
as well. But for sure, we'd have to kill it if Chris found out about it. That was really what he said. And I said, well, you know, I can work with that. And so we kept the doors locked, and only certain people could go in this room. And everyone wondered what in the hell is going on in the secret room up there. And sooner or later, you know, they found out, but not sooner in most cases. And so but the person from Altec, Bob Yarborough was his name, we had to show him certain things because he was providing equipment like ion pumps, you know, Baird-Alpert gauges and stuff
right.
that we needed. And he was really savvy, and he said, I think I know what that is that you have in there. And he, is that a residual gas analyzer is what he asked.
Right.
So ultimately I said, yes, it is, and it's just a prototype. And he said, I could sell 100 of those right now. He said, you know, he said, I really mean it. And I said, well, who would you sell them to, you know, and I quizzed him. And I pretty soon became aware he was an unusual guy, and he could sell $100. And he was, I think, their only salesman at the time. But he told his boss about it, who was the sales manager, Chuck Piercy, and then who told Bob Ward, who was the president of Altec. And ultimately, they came over and said, you know, how about working together when this product is ready to go? We think we could become, you know, an OEM for you and sell this, you know, to our customers and really help our business. And they were probably a company doing about $2 million in sales at that time, which, you know, was pretty small. So I said, well, you know, let's stay in touch and we were moving reasonably fast. And so, asked them, you know, how they would do.
Right.
Who was going to sell it, how many sales, and learned a lot about them. And so maybe in a period of 3 or 4 months, we had put together an agreement that we thought, you know, was fair and for us would provide a profit.
Right.
And would give us a sales outlet. We insisted on having the right to sell them ourselves, because we had already a lot of interest from Livermore and people like that, and the University of California at Berkeley. And we reserved the right to sell them ourselves. And we had another company approach us, Gerald Ash, who also wanted to sell them. And so at this point, we got the vice president of marketing from EAI involved. And my boss, and they were offering advice, you know, and markup, and somewhere in this period, the president of the company learned about it, and we already had, by the time he had learned about it, we already had a large number of orders, and a lot of them on the come, and with Altec, they're willing to commit to 50 or something, which we're selling them at. The price was maybe $8,000 or $9,000 is what our original thoughts were on price.
Right.
And I think the president of EAI, the first thing he did, even when he got over the shock of what had been going on without his approval, and I think he wanted to fire us and get rid of the whole thing, but he became aware that there were $2 million in orders stirring out there.
Right.
And very profitable orders. And so he, I always said he fired us all and hired us back the same day. But he did see that, you know, this would probably, you know, be a profitable business for the company. And then he got involved in the pricing, and he really wanted to hoist the price, which was probably the right thing. And so I think by the time we really got things settled with Altec to sell these, and Gerald Ash signed up, I think, for 20 or something like that, and Altec maybe 50, and that they would sell within a year, in a year's time.
Right.
And by that time, I think we were asking maybe $10,000 or $11,000 for the electronics and the probe, and the customer had to, you know, really for himself figure out, you know, where to. You know, we put it on a flange that would be compatible with his vacuum system, and Altec made sure we were, you know, industry compatible in every
right.
in every respect. So we wound up offering a commercial product, and the dates are, I think it was in 60, late 64, somewhere in there. I think it was mid or late 64 when we really introduced it. But it didn't take a lot of introducing because we had people beating their doors down.
Wow.
And we delivered the first unit to University of California Nuclear Engineering Department, and the person's name was Smith. And we quickly, you know, were accepted. I mean, it did things that nothing else around could do. And at that time, if you're trying to measure vacuum and so on, time of flight, Bendix time of flight was probably one alternative. GE magnetic residual gas analyzer was probably the most often was the one used, or Vico, I think. We were also selling one.
Those are magnetic sector.
Yeah, they were magnetic sector. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty low performance. And our sensitivity was probably 100 times, at least 100 times better.
Wow.
And it was, but I think the part that was most, we could scan very quickly.
Sure.
Where they couldn't, they were fixed, sometimes fixed, Faraday collectors.
Mm-hmm.
So they could only measure, you know, certain masses. And the idea of scanning was not really, you know, possible.
Mm-hmm.
Fast scan.
Right.
We were scanning, you know, every, you could scan in 50 milliseconds or whatever. And so we were able to do a lot of things they couldn't do, but the part that, right from the beginning with the quadrupole, was very attractive to the customer, and it was that it was a workhorse instrument. And it just ran all the time, and it didn't necessarily give, you know, the best data around, but you could have almost everything not working very well, and it still gave a reasonably good spectrum. And so we called it, right from almost from the beginning, a workhorse instrument.
Hmm.
And it really, is to this day, is that and more. And so it, with real advantages in scan speed, sensitivity, ease of use, a linear output, and workhorse capability, it really caught on in a hurry. And Altec, they sold their whole year's commitment in a few months' time.
Wow.
And they wound up, I think, they may have signed up for 20 and they sold 250 or something.
In the first year.
Yeah, and so we had a very good reception.
How were you keeping up with the demand? Did you ramp up the production really fast?
Well, we did. We had the fellow that we brought in, Dick Greenan,
mm-hmm.
was pretty experienced in production. He was a very good person, and he set up a group in a hurry, both to build quadrupoles, assemble them.
Mm-hmm.
We had a company in Redwood City that actually did the manufacturing, the grinding, and all that.
Right.
And but we did the assembly, and we learned, you know, a lot about what, you know, how to do it. It was about, the company was called R&W Associates. And so we really learned in a hurry. And I'd say Greenan had, he brought in quality people, and we were able to ramp up the manufacturing reasonably fast.
Mm-hmm.
And not fast enough for the orders, but it wasn't all that difficult. And so we really, right from the beginning, EAI at Long Branch only made that one prototype, and then we modified and copied that, and it was mostly like SRI stuff. And we had the guy on board full time, Lauren Wright. So we really, and he was in the engineering end of manufacturing, but we had basically the in-house capability of doing everything. And you know, all of a sudden we had a real business going, and I think at that point I guess I was always head of all of the EAI operations here, but I was spending most of my time in the quadrupole area, and really both helping in sales, making sure, you know, we made our commitments to Altec, meeting customers,
mm-hmm.
Learning what they were doing with them, and so on. And Mike Youthy was very helpful in that he was a physicist by training, and he really recognized the problems, and I would say technically was very, very capable. And so we had a year of immense growth, and I would say it was it was really, it was faster, it was as fast as we could handle, and basically really more than we could handle. And we kept raising the price after that until it got to about 15, and we, and with sales going up the whole time, and the competitive instrument like Time of Flight was the only one that could compete, and they weren't aware, they weren't so aware of this market at Bendix, but they were selling probably more than like 25,000 or a significant increment above us. And so we had this product launched and really going, and we built a solid state version of it, the Quad 150, I think we called it, and starting in 65, and I'd say middle 65, and it, we could sell it for $8,000 or something like that and make a good profit. And we became the most profitable part of EAI by the time,
wow,
by, let's say, 1966, the time we were really going full bore. And so these, and I don't really remember anymore or the exact numbers, but probably in the next, in the period 65-66, I think we sold more than 1,000 of these.
Wow.
Instruments, which was pretty amazing for, you know, for a new product. And with probably three salesmen.
And that's for the solid state?
For both.
Right.
The Quad 200 became the Quad 250 when we made some improvements to it. And I would say probably sold more of those in the 1,000 than we did of the Quad 150.
Mm.
But they both were doing well. The instruments worked well. We provided service from Finnegan, and there was also a person named Frank Davis working at Altec. I wouldn't say from EAI, not Finnegan.
Right, right.
There's a person from Altec who was very interested in servicing them, Frank Davis, who was a very good person, conscientious, and we had a guy, Tim Tui, and they, between them, were able to train other people and basically have a service capability, so people were able to keep them running. But most of the customers were physicists or equivalent, and so they really could keep them running themselves and preferred to, if truth be known. And in this period, like especially in 66, I used to go in on every Saturday morning. We were right down in Middlefield Road in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Because every Saturday we got a big order from Livermore. And I'd go in there, I just wanted to open the order, you know. Yeah. They were ordering like one a week. And those were house account. It was a house account. And we didn't keep too many of them in the house account, but it was a good thing we kept Livermore.
Yeah.
I think we kept LRL and Berkeley as well. We had staked out certain customers, and Livermore was our largest customer.
And so was Mike Story working on product development at that time, and you know, pushing the technology?
Yeah, Mike was working on, he was working for his whole career with EAI and Finnegan on the quadrupole. The electronic, let's say the quadrupole ceramic spacers,
mm-hmm,
the quadrupole structure, and what we call the head, and you know, the ion source,
sure,
and so on. And Mike, he had that for the life of the product, I guess, until he retired recently. And he was a vacuum chemist, so he was interested in, and we had Lauren Wright doing the electronics, and they were basically the R&D staff.
Okay.
And Lauren was equally, I would say, capable in the electronics area, and there were a lot of problems with, we could talk about for a long time if you wanted to, and that you could scan over a particular compound, or if looking at the vacuum, and then scan again, in a a minute later and, or even, you know, a few seconds later, and it wouldn't be the same.
Yeah.
We call it peak hopping. And it was due to this instabilities in the RFDC generator, mm-hmm. which is controlling, you have to control the DC off the RF and can keep the ratio constant to like one part in a million at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was not, we had things like heating of components, heating of, you know, rectifiers,
and yeah.
so on, that capacitors, various mm-hmm. things that would change the RFDC ratio, hence change the amplitudes that you were looking
okay.
at. And it was a long time before we really had solved these problems. And fortunately, most of our users didn't really care that much about that and
mm-hmm.
as when they're using it as an RGA. But we had some, like a fellow at Livermore, Norm Milleron, who would do tests of it, and he could have sunk us if he had wanted to with, you know, with his evaluations. And fortunately, we chose to work with him and to solve the problems, which mm-hmm. we needed to solve anyway,
mm-hmm.
and befriended him.
Right.
And he was on our side as a result, and he didn't. Because he was such a guru in the vacuum, the vacuum instrumentation area, that his approval really meant a lot.
Right.
Or in his disapproval, similarly. Anyway, Mike Story wanted to build a mass spec from this, and I guess we both did. And so we ultimately set up a project for that called the Quad 300, which would be a solid state version, mostly solid state version of the Quad 250,
mm-hmm.
the high end one,
mm-hmm.
and would be a mass spectrometer, but without inlets. And we were looking towards markets like GCMS, which was really an unknown market at the
right.
time. And we saw that as a step in that direction. And as I think we record in some of our papers, Hewlett Packard ordered one from us. And we really, they had just bought F&M Scientific.
Okay.
And so they,
sure.
and Bill Hewlett personally saw GC and GCMS as one business, you know, one product.
Wow.
And he recognized early on that mass spec was just another form of detector for gas chromatography, and that the two were one and the same business. And I would just say it was amazing, you know, how early he recognized that and saw the need for mass spec as a detector for the gas chromatography.
Yeah, because who? I mean, at that time, so they bought F&M. Right around 66 or?
Yeah, 66, I think they bought them.
Yeah.
It was in 66 that we were aware of it.
And then they quickly made the order to you for the spectrometer.
Yeah, the F&M people ordered it from us.
Oh, all right.
But Hewlett and Packard themselves were aware, and you know, they had been involved in the acquisition of
right.
F&M. And there's a guy, Gene Bennett at F&M, that he really saw mass spec as, you know, the detector
really?
That he needed. And I think Hewlett really climbed down in a hurry to, he had a very good feel.
So Eugene Bennett was one of the three founders of F&M, right?
Right.
And I'm just trying to think of, I should have this on the tip of my tongue, but
Aaron Martin and Gene Bennett,
right,
were two.
Right, and Frank
and
Martinez.
Frank Martinez was the third.
But at that time, in terms of GCMS, what's out there, in you know, circa 65, 66, I mean, is it just Klaus Beeman's group who's done that, or are there?
Well, there's a fellow named Roland Golke who had done it with Fred McLafferty
okay.
at Dow.
All right.
And they built one using a time of flight sometime in the 50s, I think.
Mm.
This I can't remember exactly, but it was a you know, really a breadboard kind of a
yeah.
thing, a jury rig sort of a deal. But they had run an instrument early on.
I need to pause just for a second, sir. Let's see.
I think probably it's worth at this point saying in 1966, Syntex Corporation became interested in EAI in the Scientific Instruments Division, and I'd say probably because Carl Grassi was one of the key people there. He was head of vice president of research, I think.
Right.
And Alex Zaffaroni was president of Syntex Research, and they had both come up from Mexico,
right?
And were, along with Rosencrantz, had been the three who had really done the work that led to the birth control pill,
right?
And so Carl Grassi was interested in this operation, and they approached us, and they had a guy named Ken Hansen who was their vice president of development, and he came over to express interest in what we're doing and wondering, you know, if we would like to be part of Syntex, and ultimately brought Roger Sant. We said yes, we would be interested in, you know, some relationship, a partnership or whatever, and it wasn't ours to decide, you know, whether the company was owned by it. We were owned by EAI. We were not a separate entity, but
right.
We were a separate department. So they really expressed strong interest, and which was relayed. And I think initially I met with them. And I might add, in this time period, HP, a friend of mine at HP, as probably before Syntex, approached us, Don, his name is in my paper. He worked with Bill Hewlett. He had worked with Bill personally for quite a few years, and he was in HP Labs. And he was asked by HP to look over the mass spec field, and it was about the time they acquired F&M.
Right.
And HP realized pretty early on that they would probably need a mass spectrometer, and they were looking closely at CEC, which was a magnetic
right.
mass spec
yeah.
company. And then Don came over to visit, called me. We worked on the board at University of Santa Clara together. We had for quite a few years at the physics department and ultimately the College of Arts and Sciences. And I don't know, I'm not coming up with his name. But he came over and he wanted to visit. And so we talked, and I wound up showing him a little bit about the product. Not too much, but he was already somewhat aware of it from SRI. And he's also aware that we were working with SRI. Anyway, he subsequently talked to Bill Hewlett and Packard about what the approach we were taking, the quadrupole, and I think recognized that it was a better approach for what they wanted to do than the magnetic. Around this time, Syntex put the full court press on us, and they looked over the operation and ultimately made an offer for the operation.
To acquire it. Now, with Hewlett-Packard, so this is all happening, I mean, that's a fast pace of things happening in 66, so
right.
Hewlett-Packard orders one of the Quad 300 mass
right.
spectrometer to evaluate to see how it would work
right.
with one of their new F&M corrected racks.
Exactly.
And was Hewlett-Packard when Don, whose name we'll look up, you know, later, when he came to visit.
I might have the paper.
Yeah, I think I have it. I can't believe that.
But were they thinking, they were thinking both of acquiring?
It's in the paper in Analytical Chem that I published.
Okay.
Do you have it?
I think this is the one. I was just looking for.
I can pick it off, probably.
Is this the?
Yeah, protocol, yes. Yeah.
I think it's in this paper that I have.